We'll go to India. So, just for the fun of it, because I like doing this so much. Here's the United States. A little tilted, but it's the United States. And I love it. And here's India. Good to know where India is. All right. That's where India is. Okay. So, this is Pakistan, by the way, since we were talking about Pakistan and India. So, this mountain range here, which is the Himalayas, drains down a river here called the Ganges or the Ganga on the south side, and on the north side it drains into Tibet into a river called the Tsangpo, which then comes out through a gap here and flows down and links up to the Ganges and comes out here. It's called the Brahmaputra, and there is an unbelievable amount of water that comes out of there. I mean, it makes the Mississippi River, well, maybe the Amazon is similar in that respect. It's amazing how much water comes out of there. Okay. In the 19th century, it worked. Okay. In the 19th century, here in India, in the Calcutta area, there was a temple. Oh, here we go. This is a map of the British Empire, because in the 19th century, there wasn't really exactly an India in the way in which we understand it. There was the Indian Empire, which belonged to Great Britain. And so this area up into actually what is now Iran, Baluchistan, was included in the Indian Empire. They tried to include Afghanistan, but the Afghans kicked their butts. They couldn't. All this region here, and what's now called Burma, and all the way down here, down towards Singapore, but not quite to Singapore, although the British did own Singapore. Right? So this is all considered India, a much more extensive region than the India of today. But that's also interesting because this part of India was Buddhist, and this part of India was Hindu mixed with Muslims, for what that's worth. Okay, but I just found this map when I was looking for maps. I thought it was kind of interesting. Oh, it's so small. I'm sorry. I don't know if I can make it any bigger, really. This temple was built in the 19th century on the banks of the Ganges, just outside of Calcutta. Let's see if I can get another view of it. You can look at this online later. There's another view of the temple. Temples have to have priests, and a priest was hired for this temple by the name of Ramakrishna. If I get my numbers confused here. There we go. This is a picture of Ramakrishna. That's why I was suggesting people might want to sit on this side. Photo that was taken of him, and let's see if we get a headshot. Okay, not a very imposing looking person, bad teeth. Kind of a funny expression. He was probably around 45 at this point. I think that was 7, wasn't it? I should have labeled these better. Here's a better picture of him sitting in meditation. Okay. Now, when we look at this picture of this man sitting in meditation, it doesn't look very interesting to us. He's not in an ordinary state of consciousness. It's known from the time this picture was taken that he was in a state of mind called, or in a condition called samadhi. S-A-M-A-D-H-I. Samadhi. This is a state of mind that was first described by a philosopher psychologist in the about 1,800 years ago by the name of Patanjali. You don't have to know this, I'm just going to mention it, by the name of Patanjali, who described this state of mind called samadhi. And this state of mind was often called trance in the West at the time, but what it referred to was a state of mind in which one knows no distinctions. one is experiencing pure consciousness, whatever that might mean. So in India, people would practice meditation for an entire lifetime in order to achieve this state of mind. Okay. So from the Indian point of view, this is a good thing. Let me show you another picture of him. Whoops. In this picture, and as I said, you can, all these things are online, so you can look at them after class on the course syllabus. In this picture, we see Ramakrishna is standing here. He has one hand up in the air, kind of like this. This is even before rap music. He has one hand up in the air like this, and the other one sort of like this. And he's got this big smile, and he's being held up by this student. He spontaneously went into a state of samadhi when he was listening to chanting. And this other picture that I showed, let's get rid of this one. I think it's this one here. Nope. Is a blow up of his face. And what you see on his face is radiance. Even from this 19th century picture, you look at this face and you can see a quality of radiance. Because they didn't have like a lot of light, okay, when they made these photographs. And if you look at his eyes, and look at his eyes very closely when you have the opportunity, it's very hard to tell what, if anything, he's looking at. It's a very interesting photograph. He was married. That's his wife, Sharda Devi. That's when she was younger. I don't know why I'm having so much trouble keeping this stuff straight. That's when she was older. And this picture, this guy, his name was M, and he was a local school teacher. And in the selections of Ramakrishna that we'll be reading in this class, M recorded things that he said. So we'll be reading things that Ramakrishna said as recorded by M, who'd be sitting with him. Okay. Now, for the moment, that's it for. So you find this stuff. There, images of Ramakrishna. So I suggest on the course syllabus that you take a closer look at these images on your own computer. Remember, Hick says you can't have a direct, unmediated experience of the ultimately real. And I said, whoops. Now that's important in Hick's philosophy. Because since you can't have, he says, a direct, unmediated experience of the real, it's therefore impossible to determine the actual nature of the real apart from cultural forms that point to the real, because of the way language intercedes in the process and culture intercedes in the process. So the ultimately real also always is experienced by human beings in a cultural form. The predisposition of a Christian is to have an experience of the ultimate in the form of Jesus. The predisposition of a Buddhist is to have a culturally determined ultimate experience of the real in the form of Buddha. That's what Hick says. Hick says there's no alternative to this. There is no alternative to this. Ramakrishna says he had a direct, unmediated experience of the real without any form. Now, if you can have a direct, unmediated experience of the capital R real without any form, then you know what lies behind every religion on earth. And that's what Ramakrishna claimed he had experienced. The Indian example of this is they say, if you want to know everything there is to know about jewelry, you don't need to study anything but gold. Because from the Indian point of view, all jewelry is made of gold. So if you know about gold, you know about all jewelry. It doesn't make any difference if there's platinum on top of the gold or if there are rubies or diamonds embedded in the gold. If you know about gold, you know about jewelry. This is what they're saying. So Ramakrishna is saying it's possible to know about gold. And because you know about gold, you know about all religions. And so he spoke about all religions from the point of view of gold. And that's what I want to look at in the coming week. Now, this direct unmediated experience called samadhi is actually something that can be explained. So the Indians over the course of millennia essentially wrote textbooks explaining how you could get from the common state of mind that we have now with our distractions to a state of mind which is so focused, so concentrated, that it's held on one thing alone. Now, that's in itself a little bit incomprehensible to us. When I teach a course on yoga philosophy, well, I'll just do this here. It's like, I will ask you to keep your mind on one thought, this mouse. And I'm going to ask you to pay attention to your mind as you're keeping your mind on this one thought as soon as I shut up. And tell me how long it takes before you're thinking of something other than this mouse now. Right, you're already thinking of something other than the mouse, aren't you? Yeah, it didn't take long. Yeah. Yeah. Almost instantaneously. Correct, Jason? For you? Fairly close. You were pretty concentrated on it, but only for so long. Yeah, right. Pretty fast.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Imagine that you could keep your mind focused on this mouse for an hour without another thought. That'd be pretty amazing. Imagine you could keep your mind focused on this mouse for a day without another thought. That'd be pretty amazing. Okay. So what Patanjali teaches is how to get control of your mind so you can focus it on something. Focusing it on a mouse, whether a mouse with a tail or a mouse for a computer, is kind of trivial. What would happen if you focused your mind on your mind? What would happen if you focused your consciousness on your consciousness so you could see what your consciousness was actually doing? That's the Indian prescription. Focus your awareness on the nature of awareness and find out what's actually going on in your awareness. What would happen? Now, in the Indian view, the nature of the ultimate and the nature of your own consciousness are non-different in essence. They're different in their form and their manifestation, but they're not different in essence. So if you could concentrate on the nature of consciousness and see it clearly, you need to concentrate in order to see it clearly, like concentrating on a reading assignment in order to understand it, if you could do that, then you would learn something about it that you otherwise wouldn't learn. Why would you otherwise not learn it? Because how distracted is your mind when you tried to pay attention to your own, to the mouse? You couldn't really for very long. Well, if you think that's hard, try to pay attention to your own mind for a while. That's really very hard. Okay. The other thing that was going on in ancient India was they didn't just have a textbook for how to concentrate your mind. They had ways of talking about what we would call psychology. So, in fact, the oldest psychology in the world that I can identify, anyway, is in the group of literature called the Upanishads, which date from about 600 BC. Now, we're not talking about Buddhism here, because that's another kind of psychology that's related to this. But the oldest Hindu psychology, I guess I should be more specific, is in the Upanishads. And to understand, then, how to understand what samadhi is, which is this concentrated state of mind, which is a direct, unmediated experience of the real, the very state that Hicks says we can't have. To experience samadhi, or to understand samadhi, because we're not going to experience it, to understand samadhi, you have to understand not just the cookbook technology for achieving it, but you have to understand the context in which Hindus understand the mind, which is to say you have to understand Hindu psychology. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to explain the nature of the mind according to Hindu psychology on Monday. So the rest of the class is here. On Monday, well, we wouldn't get through with it in 10 minutes anyway, believe me. So it's all right. You know, I'm sorry. I would really have preferred to do that, but with four people missing today, it's just not, and there's nothing we can do about that. Maybe they're all sick. I don't know. Okay, so we're going to talk about the Hindu psychology. What is the mind? How does the mind work? And what is the state of samadhi? And the reason we're going to do it is to understand, is it possible to have a direct, unmediated experience of reality? And the reason we want to do that is when Ramakrishna claims to have practiced all the different religions of the world and that they all went to the same place, he makes that claim on the basis of his ability to have achieved samadhi in all of those religions. So he experienced Allah because he could practice Islam in an unparalleled fashion because of the power of his concentration and his devotion. He experienced Jesus Christ directly for the same reason, and Buddha. So he's making claims that we can situate, and that's the point I'm trying to make here. Okay. So I guess we'll leave it at this point. I'm sorry about that. I don't. It wouldn't be ideal, but so it goes. Okay? Now, we do have some time, so if you want to ask me some questions, but because that's the end of my formal presentation.
Shoot.
No questions. That was too much.
What were people's response
to him? To Ramakrishna?
During that time.
He used to go in, he used to go into these trance states, and he talked about seeing God directly, and at first people thought he was crazy. Even in India, a lot of people thought he was crazy. But, you know, in the Bible it says ye shall know them by their fruits or something along those lines. As people watched him closely and spent more time with him, they realized that he may have been crazy, but he was crazy with God. And more people began to become his students and spend time with him. And as people passed through, they would, even in India of the 19th century, the word would be passed along that there's this very extraordinary yogi priest at this temple. You should drop in and see him. I don't know about now. I was in Calcutta in 1982, I think it was. Maybe it was 83. I can't get within a year, except within a year or two of dates of anything anymore. Every taxi driver in Calcutta had a picture of Ramakrishna on his dashboard.
Really?
Yeah. He was like the local saint. He was like the local saint. It's like, you know, if you went to, there's a saint that's associated with various cities in Italy, isn't there? You know, and you'd see them in, well, anyway, so he's the local saint. Yeah. He's a big deal in India. And his main student was somebody called Naren, before he became a Swami. Then he became called Swami Vivekananda. When he became a Swami, Swami is a term for like a renunciate teacher type person, not exactly a priest in the way in which we know it, but sort of a wandering meditator. In 1893, there was something in Chicago called the Parliament of Religions, which was an early attempt at learning about religious pluralism on the part of some liberal religious thinkers in the United States. It was a big deal, and they invited people from all over the world to come to the Parliament of Religions. Many people said, what's the point? We've got it right. Everybody else has got it wrong. We're not coming to anything like that. But some people did come. Somehow, an invitation got to Vivekananda in India, and he basically hitchhiked to Chicago. He managed to get on a boat somehow, and he ran out of money in San Francisco, and he rode boxcars to Chicago. So he was sleeping in the Chicago rail yards when the Parliament of Religions began, which didn't seem to bother him because he was a renunciate, wandering monk type person. He'd lived that way in India. So what were the Chicago rail yards to him? He went to the Parliament of Religions, and he spoke at the Parliament of Religions, and he blew everybody away. He so blew everybody away that he became instantly famous all over the United States and was invited to Harvard University, where he blew everybody away, which made him even more famous. And he traveled around the United States at that point talking about Indian religion in a way that nobody had ever heard anybody talk about Indian religion. At that time, people's idea of Indian religion was people sleeping on a bed of nails or something like that, or charming cobras or whatever. And here was this person who was talking about this incredible spiritual sophistication, right? So he was having dinner party conversations with Harvard professors, speaking at their level. They're all blown away by this. And when he came back to India after all of that, the Indians treated him as a national hero, because it was sort of like, here's this Indian that goes to the West. India, from the point of view of the Western world, and Britain in particular, was like trash. The way the British treated India is, I could talk about that at another lecture, it'd be unbelievable how badly people were treated there. By most British, not by all, but treated very badly. He was treated as a national hero, and therefore his teacher, who had died at that point, because he was his teacher, right, is even more a hero, because the hero is the student of the, right, so that's kind of, and so then the whole view of things changed. So now Ramakrishna is a big deal in India, and has been for a while, okay. But at the time that he was younger, is this guy crazy? Can anybody have these experiences? Yeah, they can. Okay, no more questions? Sorry if I bored you, but yes.
I'm kind of curious, from what I've read so far, nobody really tries to tackle atheism. It's not really discussed.
It's not discussed by Hick, is it?
No.
No, it's not.
I just kind of was curious where that fits into everything. Because I guess in like your tree example, that would be like a blind man that can't see the tree, right?
Well, that's a really interesting question, you know, because it gets us actually into talking about science and modern culture and maybe Badgley Hall, right? Although what's interesting, I have to say something here, that what's very interesting is at the time at this university that there was a lot of conversation about getting rid of the religious studies minor and religious studies courses. Some of the strongest proponents for keeping the study of religion at this university were the science faculty, even though they're atheists, which is interesting why that is. And mostly the reason why it is because they encounter students with a lot of strange ideas, and they would like those students to be disavowed of those strange ideas. And that's why they're interested in having somebody teach courses about comparative religion and whatnot. Let me think about this, and maybe I will speak to it when we start up class again. I'm thinking that that's an important question, and I don't want to give an offhand answer to it. So I want to dwell on it a little bit and give it the depth of response I think it deserves. How's that? Is that good? Okay. Okay, y'all. I don't know. Oh.